Thank you for joining us. This is Craig Lubo, and this is Radioactive Magazine. And I did an interview with Sister Helen Prejean back on March 5th, and that's what we're playing tonight. This was about the death penalty. She spoke in Lawrence at the time. And
not been published yet, River of Fire. And as you might guess from what I just said, I'd be talking about the death penalty and repealing it and other aspects of it and social aspects of it. Welcome, sister.
Thank you. Really good to be here.
Hey, so tell me, let's start out with River of Fire. What is that book going to be about?
It's like the prequel to Dead Man Walking. It's the spiritual journey that took me to death row, and something I never dreamed I'd do when I became a nun and a teacher in a Catholic school, and then worked in a Catholic parish in religious ed, Bible studies. But it was an awakening, that gospel of Jesus. I'd always thought that it was about charity, and it is, for us to be kind, charity. But I never got the part about justice, social justice. And a lot of that is revealed as I do in the book, that I was kind of living in a cushioned life, a bubble, because surrounded by privilege, both in the neighborhood I lived in and the suburbs. And then as a nun, we had all our needs taken care of, health care, everything. And my approach to the world was that if I prayed, really prayed hard, that God would help people. That some problems seemed so big to me that it was going to take God. And then the awakening came that really what the gospel of Jesus was about was that when he preached to poor people, it was not, it's God's will for you to be poor, so be good poor people and obedient to God. It was that it's against your dignity to be poor, and you have a right to strive for what is rightfully yours, and to resist, and that's where justice comes in. And so there was an awakening, and it led me to move into the St. Thomas Housing Projects in New Orleans among African-American people, and they became my teachers about the other America, about how everything was different, all the rules were different, how the police treated you, that you couldn't get loans in banks because your neighborhood was redlined, that you couldn't buy houses in some parts of the city, that you had to stay in certain segregated parts of the city. And then as real estate got more and more expensive with gentrification, they could not afford to move out. Like one woman said, it's like we live on a reservation here. And I also learned, I think the thing that shocked me most profoundly, because education had meant so much to me, and I joined the Sisters of St. Joseph because I wanted to be a teacher, of just the abysmal state of education in the public schools. And so young people were coming in who had gotten as far as their junior year in high school, and they couldn't read a third grade reader. It shocked me, because I'd gone to a really good Catholic school and knew how to do public speaking by the time I was a junior. All these things shocked me, and I realized how out of it I had been. I had been in my little cushion world and participated in the Catholic education system in New Orleans, where you had the one track where parents that could pay tuition sent their kids to the private schools. Then the public schools were left to flounder on their own. And so it just a fire started burning my heart for justice, that I couldn't be neutral about this, and I'm not a savior, great white savior coming in to save people, but to join them in their struggle for justice. And then one day got an invitation to write a man on death row while I was in St. Thomas, and I just saw it as, well, I'm here to serve poor people if he's here on death row, because the street knowledge was, the street saying was, capital punishment means them without the capital get the punishment. It's all poor people. So I thought I was only going to be writing letters, and the rest is history.
And when you had this awakening, what time frame are we talking about?
So we're talking about a time frame of 1980. I remember where I was and where I heard a talk. And for the first time, I realized how active you're supposed to be in terms of the gospel of Jesus. That you don't just pray for God to change the world. The prayer leads God to change me. And then I roll up my sleeves and collaborate for justice to come in the world. So without me, without our collaboration, can't happen.
And in your speech tonight in Dead Man Walking, you interviewed, or I guess I wouldn't say interviewed, but you met with and prayed with the father of one of the victims.
Lloyd LeBlanc, good French Cajun man, whose son David had been murdered in cold blood, just shot in the back of the head and killed. And so it was Lloyd LeBlanc who reached out to me and invited me to come pray with him in that little chapel, and who took me into his heart and into his journey, away from the hatred and the anger and vengeance to forgiveness. And he was the first one, Craig, I ever met who taught me that it was that he was dying inside from the anger, and that he hated to see that he was losing himself like that, because he was a kind person and he loved to help people. And so when he told me about it, and he just put his hand down, and then he said, because I was filled with all this anger all the time, put his hand down, like, stop, and said, then I said, they killed my boy, but I'm not going to let them kill me. And he helped me understand so vividly that to get caught up in the anger is to also lose your life. And so that's, none of us can preach that, but the victims' families can teach us that, because they've been in the fire.
And did his feelings about that, did that help him move to it? Was he able to forgive the perpetrator?
Absolutely. And the mother of Patton, Eddie Saunier, who she lived in that little town, and she was so hated by all the neighbors and treated with such disrespect, people cutting up dead animals, throwing them on her front porch, saying things when she came to the store to get groceries, she could overhear them. And one day she heard someone on her front porch, and she had the blinds drawn, she had had her telephone disconnected, and was really living like a little hermit in the town. And so she looks through the blinds, and she sees somebody standing there, and she sees he has something in his hands, and had color to it. She opened up the door, and it was Lloyd LeBlanc, the father of David. And he hands her a basket of fruit. And he said, Miss Sonia, I know you've been having a hard time in this town. He said, look, I'm a parent, like you. And as parents, we never know what our kids might do. They're their own beings. And I don't hold you responsible for the death of our son. And here's my number. If you need me, you call me. And then later on, Miss Sonia died, and I was there at the funeral. There was Lloyd LeBlanc at her funeral. See, he was a man who he just brought out, really. People think forgiveness. He said to me, people say to me, Lloyd, you got to be for the death penalty. It looked like you didn't love your boy. Now, that's culture speaking, you know, and a lot of people in Louisiana supported the death penalty. And he said, they see forgiveness as weakness, that you're basically condoning what they did. Like, you killed my son, but I forgive you. Like, well, basically, it's okay. But he said, I don't see it that way at all. He said, I see it as saving my own life. Otherwise, I would have been buried in the anger and the hatred, and I'd have lost my life too.
Now, you had met at one point, as I recall, the parents of the other victim.
Yeah, Loretta Bork was killed. It was fleeting, our meeting. It was walking outside while the pardon board was meeting, and we ran into each other literally in front of the building, and they averted. They were just very, very furious with me. They stayed furious with me. And I don't blame them. They were caught. You know, when you think of it, there's trauma, grief, loss, families struggle tremendously. Siblings get lost. I was never able really to reconcile with them. So I had done it all wrong. I hadn't reached out to them, so I always put the blame on myself because they were in such trauma. And one of the things that happens in families. This was not this family, but another one where her sister had been killed. The parents got so caught up in seeking the death penalty or helping other victims' families that she got lost. They always remembered her sister's birthday, forgot hers. Always the anniversary of her date, of her death. And then parents who lose a child started going to these support groups of parents of murdered children to hear their stories. Oh my. It was a rainy night and a lot of people didn't show up. I was glad. I don't think the room could have held any more pain. Everybody telling their story was just so sad. Hard.
So going back to the parents, have they reached out or have they contacted you at all since then?
No. I'm very angry when the...
So you think they're still that?
I sent them the book. Was that all the victims' families? The book for them to see and to just ask them for their feedback or if I'd gotten anything wrong. Mm-hmm. They never responded. And they were just furious.
Yeah.
When the movie came out, they thought, oh, there's that nun getting a lot of money. She's probably going to go to the Oscars and all, and here we are suffering. But it was really sad. It was just really, really hard.
Characteristics of people who end up on death row. You talked about poor people and race.
Poor people, usually, who have killed white people.
And are these mostly people, because you mentioned in Louisiana how dismal the education was. Are most of the people on death row victims of poor educational system, too?
Absolutely. And abuse. The statistics are really high, 80 or 90% of people on death row. This is not just Louisiana. Were abused as children.
Okay.
The violence pumped into them, one day they take out on some poor innocent soul. And, so when you have a culture riddled with violence and abuse, it just, you know, it triggers other violence. It's not to excuse them. Mm-hmm. It's just their lives have been miserable lives in so many ways. And then they do a terrible thing.
And so if the legislature were to maybe take the money that's being spent, that some people would say is being wasted on death penalty, and
yeah,
apply it to mental illness.
Absolutely.
That might help reduce crime,
yeah,
more than...
I mean, you know what? Like Martin Luther King said that a budget is a moral document.
Uh-huh.
When you look at the huge amount of money that's put into prison systems instead of education, and instead of it, health care, mental illness, you just see that, you know, our priorities are that we believe in locking people up and punishing them for crime, but not addressing the roots or the at-risk kids. So we need a real shift and conversion of our souls to move toward being a people of life, I mean real life for people.
When you have those extreme cases, like the one that you pastored in Louisiana, and the most egregious types of cases, how do you then address it with the public in terms of culture and getting them to change their view on that when they see something that extreme?
Yeah. And that's a really hard of a question, because you got to take people with you. See, when I was writing Dead Man Walking, you never would have heard of it if Jason Epstein hadn't been my editor. Because in the first draft of the book, I waited real long before I talked about the crime and the egregiousness of killing two teenage kids in cold blood. And so when Jason looked at it, he said, "Helen, you wait far too long to really face with the reader this horrible, unspeakable crime. And people are going to think that you're not going to really face up to that. You know, you're a Catholic nun, you believe in the forgiveness of Jesus, it's all the human rights of this murder and all. And I've learned that you got to take people with you. First, in the way I wrote the book, I got it back, redid it, put the crime up front and center. And I take people there with me whenever I get up to speak. And that's the crunch of the book. That's the rubber band of the book. That's the tension of the book. And why it made such a good movie. Tim Robbins said that's the easiest screenplay he ever wrote because you go have both sides, the suffering victim's family, the other family. And you got to take people into the crime. You have to. And I had to learn that. And to face it with them. Because, see, in order to deal with the death penalty, people have to deal with their own outrage over crime, just their horror at crime. Because then the way they can easily be manipulated is anybody who did that deserves to die. That's why we have the death penalty. And that's the way the conversation has gone. But then to face the egregiousness of the crime and to be outraged over it, but then to go and just step by step see what it means then for the state to take a person and to get them out of that holding cell, and the guards that have to do the killing, and to kill them for what they've done. You got to take them into, ooh, this is about us. They do terrible things, but this is about us. But it's an art to take them there, and I've had to learn how to do that.
And with part of that, to the extent that you succeeded reaching some of those people,
is
a lot of that maybe because of the number of people who have been exonerated.
That's a factor. That shocked us as a people. I thought we had a perfect court system.
Yeah.
That's been a shock. Mm-hmm. Learning the cost has been a shock. Mm-hmm. See, like Kansas isn't what I call a real practitioner state of the death penalty. You probably, in all probability, are never going to execute anybody. And so when you have to ask a question, who benefits from the death penalty? They have 750 people on death row in California. They're never going to execute them. The last execution was, 15 years ago? So who's benefiting? And you got to see political currency. Who gets political points? And you see that it's 95% about politics, 5%, if that, about criminal justice. And so you have to expose it for what it is. And then just help good people to just see, is this who we want to be as a society? That's where you bring it.
So, for those who are in government and people running for governor who use the issue to try to capitalize on political currency, the fact that the nation as a whole is moving more toward repeal.
Right. So it's
is that going to influence those
governments? Yeah, it is. It already is. You don't see wholehearted support for the death penalty. In fact, it may not even be mentioned in a campaign. Look at the national...
But in Missouri, the governor, I think I saw is like 5 warrants this year something.
No, see, and that's the way the power is distributed, that uh-huh. governors, like the guy in Florida,
mm-hmm.
boy, he's just said, bring me all the warrants.
Yeah.
And so they can do, they have the power. And mm-hmm. you can be sure, whenever a governor does that, who's he looking toward? Whose favor is he winning? His constituents. Mm-hmm. He's out to get votes when he runs. So, as we saw happening in Oklahoma, Mary Fallon was the governor, and she would go to the basketball games while people were being executed. She turned, you know, that was in their hands. And all for it.
Did she ever witness an execution that you know of?
No, they never get close.
Okay.
That's by design.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, and then it got exposed over this man, Richard Glossop, that this guy, that because we brought such world attention to his case, he's an innocent guy, and it exposed them, and everything came out that they were experimenting with drugs, using drugs that were illegal, the whole bit, and they busted open the whole thing. And so you haven't heard Booscat from her about the death penalty anymore. And it changed the hearts and minds of a lot of people in Oklahoma. So it's not that, and the polls show that even if people say they're for it, that's in a theoretical death penalty. If people do a terrible crime, do you believe, you know. But the more they, you give them alternatives, like, well, look, out of these two, life without parole or that, are you for the death penalty? It drops tremendously. In fact, last year, nationally, or year before, more people favored life without parole than death. That's way, way down from the 90s. Because it's education and experience, and all the stories coming out of the mistakes and all that play a part.
So, on that, though, you, if it's for political reasons, though, why is it centered in three or four states more than... Because many, many other states that are just as conservative as Missouri and Arkansas and Texas, they're not executing people.
No, well, that's a very interesting question there. You get a culture in a state, and where the criteria that the Supreme Court has set don't hold up, culture takes over. And so you begin to have a history. So in a state where you have really pro-rabid death penalty prosecutors, governors, you don't just shake that overnight. And it takes some time for the people. You have to have a lot of education for that to shift and to change. Texas is really a good example of that. I mean, because I think they used to get on average 48 death sentences a year. With Houston, or Harris County, Houston, getting a huge percentage of it. Last year, they didn't have any. And you know what one of the factors was? That for the first time, well, about 10 years ago, they voted that life without parole will be the alternative. And it used to be they wouldn't even tell juries who were going in, it's been a terrible crime if the person was going to get death or not. They'd send a note to the judge, if we don't give death, what will the sentence be? Because they want to protect the public, right? And they wouldn't answer. They didn't know that the alternative was that person was going to be in prison for the rest of his life or her life. And they had to get a unanimous decision, so huge pressure on them. And they weren't told the alternative. And once that came in, it just started going down, 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 because most human beings do not want to sentence another human being to death and have to carry that for the rest of their life. We could spend a whole lot of time just talking about jurors.
Yeah, and that was, I did an interview with Lindy Liu earlier this year.
Lindy Liu.
Who was the, I forget what state, she was known as juror number two.
Oh, okay.
And she was on like a 10-year crusade to reach out to the other jurors on the panel to see how they felt. She was tormented because she had voted for the death penalty.
Yeah,
and
really.
Very tormented about it. So,
yeah. It's too much to ask you.
Yeah. The last question I've got. You speak, obviously, since you're a nun, from the Christian perspective. And
but from human rights as well.
Right. So my question is, how do you address when you, like if you were addressing a group of Muslims or Jewish people?
Human rights.
Okay.
Is the path for everybody today.
Uh-huh.
No matter if you have faith, if you step in a church, you know. And more people are not stepping in churches.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're dealing with, and so human rights, we can all stand in that together.
Okay.
And that's what connects us.
In the pro-life movement, for you, that includes death penalty.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's what that conversation with the Pope was about. How can we just say about dignity of life? But there's no dignity in rendering a person defenseless and then killing them. It's a premeditated, intentional killing of someone who's been rendered defenseless. And that crosses a moral line. So we're making progress on it.
Okay, well, thank you for being here. For those just joining us, you've been listening to Sister Helen Prejean, and we've been talking about the death penalty, and thank you for joining us.